Right now, there is $500 million just sitting in this massive legal stalemate. On one side, you have millions of everyday gamers who feel, well, like they've been overcharged.
And on the other side, some of the biggest tech giants on the planet absolutely refusing to write a refund check.
Exactly. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are cracking open the September 4th, 2026 edition of the Tikkun Morning Briefing.
Which is packed today, by the way.
Oh, it really is. And the mission for you today is to look at this massive, undeniable friction point happening across the globe. We all imagine the future as this, smooth, frictionless digital utopia.
Right. But the reality is our digital ambitions are just violently crashing into physical, economic, and frankly, legacy roadblocks.
Yeah, we have a wild journey for you today. We're unpacking that $500 million showdown over your living room consoles, then looking at why brand new corporate laptops are just completely imploding out of the box.
Which is a mess. Plus, lightning-fast AI swarms taking over cybersecurity, sovereign wealth entering crypto, and a delayed mission to hunt for alien life in the toxic clouds of Venus.
So let's unpack this first piece because it hits right at the wallet, right? We're looking at friction at the macroeconomic level, basically huge corporate windfalls clashing with your everyday expectations as a consumer.
Right, so earlier this year, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a series of retaliatory hardware import tariffs. They ruled them unlawful.
Which basically means the court said, hey, you cannot tax these imported electronics this way.
Exactly. And as a direct result, manufacturers are getting billions in federal tariff rebates. Sony specifically is set to receive an estimated $508 million in direct government repayments.
Which is just a crazy injection of cash. I mean, $500 million just handed back to the balance sheet.
Yeah, but the friction happens when you look back at 2024 and 2025.
Right, because when those tariffs originally hit, Sony and Microsoft raised the retail prices, the MSRP of the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X.
And they pointed directly at the tariffs as the reason.
Yeah, they did. So now, consumers in California and Washington have filed class action lawsuits claiming unjust enrichment. They're basically arguing, hey, you raised the price of the plastic box because of the tax. The government gave you the tax money back. You owe us a refund, or like at least a price drop.
But the tech giants are mounting a very aggressive defense against that exact logic. They filed joint motions to dismiss the lawsuits entirely.
Claiming they have no legal or statutory obligation to pass a single dime of those refunds down to you, the consumer.
Right. They're essentially saying these were voluntary transactions at fair market prices.
Let me throw a real-world analogy at this and see if it holds up. Like, if a local bakery raises the price of a chocolate cake because the price of flour skyrocketed,
All
right?
right.
And then a month later, flour gets dirt cheap again, the bakery doesn't legally owe you a refund for the cakes you already ate, do they? So do these consumers actually have a leg to stand on in court?
What's fascinating here is the economic principle at play, something economists call price stickiness.
Price stickiness.
Yeah. In a perfectly theoretical, perfectly elastic market, the answer is yes. When the bill of materials costs go down, retail prices should immediately drop to match.
But I'm guessing global conglomerates don't operate in a theoretical textbook.
Not at all. They use these macroeconomic shocks to fundamentally expand their margins.
So they use the crisis as cover to just permanently reset the price floor.
That is exactly the mechanism.
Yeah.
When the tariff hit, they pass the financial friction directly onto you. They socialize the cost.
Wow.
But when the judicial review invalidated the duty, that transmission mechanism miraculously stalled out. They privatized the windfall.
Meaning they absorbed that $508 million, not as a discount fund for gamers, but as, well, extraordinary non-operating cash flow.
Exactly. And from a strictly legal standpoint, the unjust enrichment doctrine is incredibly difficult to prove when a consumer voluntarily handed over their credit card for a working product at an advertised price.
Because you suffered no legally cognizable economic injury. You paid for a PlayStation and you received a PlayStation.
Right. And Sony is already showing us exactly how they plan to spend that non-operating cash flow.
Oh, yeah. Right in the middle of fighting this lawsuit, they announced a massive 35-minute state of play broadcast for September 2026. The entire focus is the new PlayStation 5 Pro.
And they are throwing around some incredibly heavy jargon to justify the new price tag.
Yeah, they're talking about proprietary machine learning upscaling, PlayStation Spectral Super Resolution, or PSSR, and hardware-accelerated ray tracing at unlocked 4K at 60 frames per second.
Which sounds like a lot.
It sounds like a total word salad. Let's pause and unpack those terms for the listener. Let's start with ray tracing.
Okay, so think about how old video games used to render light. Developers basically had to paint the light onto the objects like a theatrical set.
Like a static illusion.
Exactly. Ray tracing changes the physics of the game engine entirely. It uses dedicated silicon on the chip to mathematically simulate the physical path of individual photons of light in real time.
So when light hits a puddle in a game, it reflects off the water, bounces onto a brick wall, and tints the wall slightly blue.
Yes. But it requires immense computational horsepower, which is why it historically tanked the game's frame rate.
Which is where this PSSR thing comes in, right? The machine learning upscaling.
Yeah. Running full ray tracing at a 4K resolution is just too hard, even for a PS5 Pro. So PSSR uses an onboard AI model to cheat, essentially.
Cheat? How so?
The console only actually renders the game at a much lower, blurrier resolution, say 1080p, so it runs incredibly fast.
Oh, I see.
Then the AI instantly predicts and fills in the missing pixels to make it look perfectly sharp at 4K.
Wow, so they took the $500 million they saved on tariffs, poured into R&D for AI pixel guessing and simulated photons, and used that to sell you an even more expensive piece of hardware.
The machinery of corporate hardware marches forward.
Well, speaking of hardware marching forward, we are seeing a totally different kind of friction over at Microsoft.
Yeah. Definitely.
Sony might be successfully defending its bottom line, but Microsoft is currently facing a catastrophic engineering failure on the ground. We're moving from economic friction to architectural friction.
Right. Their ambition to dominate the hardware space is slamming face first into the brittle reality of their own legacy code.
Which brings us to the new Windows 11 ARM laptops. It is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, if you are an enterprise IT admin right now, you are having a terrible week.
Seriously. Microsoft Teams and Microsoft Outlook are suffering fatal crash loops. We're not talking about lag, we're talking about immediate hard crashes upon launch.
And this is specifically localized to the brand new, highly touted Snapdragon X Elite and Snapdragon X Plus Windows 11 Copilot Plus laptops.
Right, the machines Microsoft promised would be the ultimate future of corporate mobility.
The irony is that the hardware itself is brilliant, but they are completely paralyzed out of the box because of the software.
We dug into the system's diagnostics, and it essentially boils down to, get this, an unresolved memory pointer misalignment within the Chromium-based WebView 2 shared runtime environment.
And apparently, this flaw is fighting with Microsoft AIM's proprietary Prism instruction translation layer.
Which is wild. Microsoft's temporary fix for corporate workers is basically telling them to open a web browser and use the web app versions of Teams and Outlook until an emergency hotfix is ready.
Right.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. It's like dropping a cutting-edge, ultra-efficient electric motor into a classic car, but relying on a rusted, duct-taped 30-year-old gearbox to connect them.
That is actually a very accurate way to visualize an emulation bridge.
But I have to push back here. Apple transitioned their entire laptop lineup to custom ARM silicon years ago, and it was virtually seamless. You opened an old Intel app, and it just worked. Why is Microsoft dropping the ball so spectacularly on the exact same transition?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, you uncover the ultimate double-edged sword of Microsoft's business model. Apple controls their entire ecosystem, hardware and software.
Right.
When they moved to Apple Silicon, they ruthlessly cut off support for old legacy apps. They force developers to update or die.
But Microsoft can't do that.
You know, Microsoft cannot do that.
Yeah.
Their entire trillion-dollar enterprise monopoly is built on backward compatibility. Corporate IT departments are deeply tethered to software built 10, 15, or 20 years ago.
So Microsoft is dragging a 30-year anchor of old code behind them.
They're forced to. And when you try to run complex productivity frameworks like Teams, which relies on WebView 2, essentially a heavy web browser running in the background,
yeah,
on a totally different processor architecture like ARM, you have to use nested software abstractions.
You have to translate the language.
Yes. The Snapdragon chip speaks ARM, but the old software speaks x86. So Microsoft built Prism, which is a real-time translator trying to convert billions of x86 instructions into ARM instructions on the fly.
Wow.
But a memory pointer misalignment means the abstraction layers got confused about where a specific piece of data was actually stored in the physical RAM. The translator looked at the wrong line in the dictionary.
And when a computer looks for data that isn't there, it panics and shuts down the app.
It throws a fatal exception. It proves a vital architectural truth for the industry.
Which is?
Raw silicon efficiency on a new microchip absolutely cannot compensate for brittle, layered software translation. You cannot outcompute bad legacy code.
It's a massive reality check, and it naturally leads us to how the broader tech industry is trying to solve the problem of brittle human-engineered code.
Right. Their solution is to just remove humans from the loop entirely.
Exactly. Let's look at Google's massive dual launch today, Gemini 3.8 Flash and Gemini Cyber. AI is officially graduating from a neat chatbot to foundational unattended infrastructure.
This is a major maturation in how we think about compute.
Let's start with Gemini 3.8 Flash. Google is boasting that they dropped the inference latency, the time to first token, to sub 120 milliseconds.
That's incredibly fast.
It also features a 2 million token context window with asynchronous KV cache memory offloading. They say the goal is to allow autonomous multi-agent swarms to execute parallel tool calls without bottlenecks. Let's pause, though. Why does that 120 millisecond mark matter so much? I mean, to a human, the difference between half a second and 120 milliseconds is barely noticeable.
To a human reading a poem, it doesn't matter at all. But we are talking about agentic swarms. In complex enterprise environments, you don't just have one AI model thinking about a problem.
You have a bunch of them.
Exactly. You deploy an ensemble. You might have one AI agent writing code, another AI agent checking that code for errors, a third agent compiling it, and a fourth agent testing it against a database.
So they are constantly talking to each other, executing thousands of automated tool calls.
Right. If every single one of those agents takes 400 or 500 milliseconds to respond to a prompt, the operational bottlenecks compound geometrically.
Oh, I see. So it's about network traffic.
Yes. A task that should take seconds suddenly takes minutes. The entire pipeline bogs down. By driving the response time down to sub 120 milliseconds, you achieve something closer to deterministic execution.
Meaning the swarm operates at the speed of a traditional software script.
And
how does the asynchronous KV cache memory offloading help that speed? Because that sounds incredibly dense.
Well, a KV cache, key value cache, is essentially the AI's short-term working memory of the conversation it is currently having.
Okay.
Historically, an AI had to pause its core processing to update that memory log. It was a bottleneck.
But by making the process asynchronous,
the AI can continuously generate new thoughts and execute actions while a separate background process handles filing away the memory. It stops the compute clusters from saturating.
Which brings us to the second part of their launch, Gemini Cyber. This is their enterprise defense model.
This one is fascinating.
Yeah, the briefing notes, it was trained on hundreds of terabytes of decompiled assembly code, raw binaries, historic vulnerability databases, and live attack telemetry.
Its entire purpose is to act as an autonomous reverse engineering engine.
To synthesize verified security patches before a zero-day exploitation can happen.
Yes.
Okay, wait, let me play devil's advocate here. Aren't we just handing an AI the keys to fight other AI?
Basically, yes.
Yeah. I mean, if Gemini Cyber can reverse engineer vulnerabilities to write patches autonomously, bad actors can use similar models to autonomously write viruses to exploit them. Where does a human even sit in that room anymore?
This raises an important question about the shifting finish line of the AI race and, frankly, the role of human engineering.
How so?
The frontier used to be about parameter expansion, just making the models bigger so they could read more of the internet. Now the race is about operational autonomy at scale.
We are just letting them loose in the system.
We have to. The speed of AI-generated attacks is already outpacing human response times. When Gemini Cyber audits a proprietary code base, it is doing the work of 1,000 security analysts in milliseconds. Mm.
Wow.
The role of the human cybersecurity engineer is no longer finding the needle in the haystack. The AI does that.
So what does the human do?
The human's job is now managing the AI system that burns the haystack down, setting the parameters, and ensuring the autonomous agents don't hallucinate a patch that accidentally breaks the network.
It is a total paradigm shift in how we maintain our digital infrastructure. We're building systems that run themselves. And just as AI is maturing from a novelty into foundational enterprise infrastructure, we are watching digital finance go through the exact same institutional maturation.
It really is the formal institutionalization of digital wealth.
Right. Cryptographic assets are finally moving from the speculative fringes into tier one global banking. Standard Chartered, A massive London-headquartered Tier 1 bank just launched physical spot Bitcoin and Ether trading.
Along with institutional custody in the United Arab Emirates.
And they are operating under the very rigorous regulatory authorization of the Dubai Financial Services Authority, the DFSA.
Which is a huge deal.
Yeah. This isn't an anonymous tech enthusiast trading coins on a laptop in a coffee shop anymore. This is literal sovereign wealth flowing through a global banking titan.
You really have to look at the phrasing from Standard Chartered head of digital asset markets. They stated that the era of institutional hesitation is definitively over.
Let me stop you right there. Why was there so much institutional hesitation before? Crypto has been around for over a decade. Trillions of dollars have moved through it.
Sure.
So why did it take this long for sovereign wealth to take it seriously?
Two words for you. Counterparty risk. For a sovereign wealth fund, a family office, or a multinational hedge fund, you cannot rely on an unregulated offshore exchange run by a 20-something CEO.
Right. If the exchange collapses or gets hacked, your state-level treasury just vanishes.
Which is exactly what happened with FTX and others.
Exactly.
That is precisely why the key phrase in this intelligence briefing is physical spot.
Right. The briefing makes a huge point to note this is not a synthetic ETF or a derivative instrument. Why does that distinction matter so much to a hedge fund?
Because an ETF is just a paper contract. It allows you to bet on the price movement of Bitcoin without actually holding the underlying asset.
You're relying on a complex chain of intermediaries.
Right. What Standard Chartered is offering in the UAE is direct, high liquidity spot execution. They are buying the actual cryptographic keys on the blockchain.
Okay, I see the difference.
And more importantly, they are providing custody in specialized defense-grade digital vaults.
Okay. What exactly makes a digital vault defense-grade? I mean, it's just computer code, isn't it?
It is a blend of extreme cryptography and physical security. We are talking about cold storage solutions where the cryptographic keys to the assets are generated and stored on physical hardware modules.
Oh, wow.
And they are permanently disconnected from the internet, completely air-gapped.
Okay, so how do you even move the funds then?
To move the funds, it requires multi-signature authentication. Multiple authorized individuals in different geographic locations have to physically plug in hardware keys to sign the transaction.
It's like requiring two generals to turn the keys on a nuclear submarine at the exact same time.
It's very similar. And bringing all that infrastructure under the regulatory umbrella of the DFSA in Dubai provides an unprecedented layer of legitimacy.
It acts as a massive catalyst.
Exactly. It clears the runway for an enormous capital reallocation across the entire Middle East and North Africa region. It proves that physical cryptocurrency execution is no longer a wild speculation. It is a foundational pillar of modern corporate treasury diversification.
So if we look at the board right now, we have AI swarms operating in under 120 milliseconds, and we have instant global capital flowing into defense-grade cryptographic vaults. We are moving at light speed.
We really are.
But for all of our breakthroughs in the digital realm, humanity is still ultimately chained to a giant rock, bound by the unhackable laws of physics. Which brings us to our final story, space exploration.
Where you cannot just push an emergency software hotfix.
Absolutely not. Rocket Lab, working in a formal collaboration with researchers from MIT, has officially delayed the historic first privately funded mission to Venus.
It is now pushed to early 2027.
And the sheer audacity of this mission profile is staggering. They are planning to drop a miniaturized high-velocity probe directly into the Venusian cloud deck.
Somewhere between 48 and 60 kilometers in altitude.
And this is not a gentle, cloudy day. They are dropping it into a supercritical carbon dioxide and sulfuric acid atmosphere.
It's brutal.
Pause on that. What does supercritical actually mean in this context? Because it sounds terrifying.
Oh, it is one of the most hostile environments in our solar system. A supercritical fluid is a state of matter that happens under extreme heat and extreme pressure.
Okay.
The carbon dioxide is squeezed so hard that the distinct boundary between a gas and a liquid completely disappears.
So it's both.
Basically. It has the density of a liquid, but expands to fill space like a gas. It will dissolve almost anything you put into it.
We are literally talking about dropping a delicate probe into a boiling ocean of acidic gas to look for alien life.
Yes, we are.
The briefing says they are using an onboard autofluorescence nephelometer to analyze organic chemistry and look for phosphine. I have to ask, how does shooting light into a cloud of toxic gas tell us if aliens are breathing in there?
Well, a nephelometer measures the size and concentration of suspended particles by shining a specific wavelength of light into a medium. and measuring how that light scatters.
Like headlights.
Yeah, imagine driving through thick fog with your high beams on. The way the light bounces back tells you how dense the fog is.
Except in this case, the fog is sulfuric acid.
Right, and the autofluorescence part means they are looking for particles that absorb that light and emit a different color back.
Oh, I see.
Certain complex organic molecules react this way. They are specifically hunting for phosphine gas. On Earth, phosphine is a biosignature.
Meaning it comes from living things.
Yes, it is primarily produced by anaerobic microbial life, bacteria that don't need oxygen. If they find it suspended in the Venusian clouds, it is a very strong indicator of microbial metabolic processes happening right now.
It is absolutely mind-blowing. So why the delay? Why are they pushing this back to 2027?
Well, Rocket Lab CEO Peter Beck confirmed the delay is tied to testing schedules for their new reusable medium-lift neutron rocket.
Specifically, they need additional margin validation on the static hot fire qualifications for the Archimedes methane oxygen second stage engines.
And this perfectly encapsulates the ultimate friction between digital ambition and physical reality.
How so?
If Google wants to update Gemini, they recompile the code base and deploy it to a server. If Rocket Lab wants to go to Venus, they have to physically burn thousands of gallons of liquid methane and liquid oxygen in a controlled explosion and ensure the metallurgy of the engine bell doesn't melt under unimaginable thermal stress.
Wow, yeah. You can't simulate that perfectly in a computer. You have to actually light the fire.
And you are on a cosmic clock. Orbital mechanics do not care about your corporate timeline.
Because Venus and Earth only align for an optimal, fuel-efficient transit trajectory once every 19 months, right?
Exactly. If your Archimedes engine needs just a few more weeks of hot fire testing to be safe, you cannot just launch next month. You have missed the planetary window. You wait a year and a half for the solar system to align again.
It is the ultimate physical constraint. So what does this all mean? Let's recap the journey you've been on with us today. We've seen Sony use the friction of supply chain tariffs to insulate its balance sheet with a $508 million windfall.
Turning it right into AI-upscaled gaming hardware.
We've watched Microsoft's enterprise mobility dreams crash headfirst into the brittle reality of 30-year-old by 86 software emulation.
We've seen Google deploy autonomous AI swarms operating in milliseconds to write cyber defenses entirely without us.
We've witnessed Standard Chartered open the floodgates for sovereign wealth into defense-grade crypto vaults in the UAE. And finally, we've seen a private hunt for alien life in the acidic clouds of Venus delayed by the unyielding realities of rocket engineering and planetary alignment.
It leaves you with this inescapable tension. In a future where AI agents can reverse engineer software vulnerabilities in a fraction of a second, and digital sovereign wealth can move globally at the speed of light, it raises an important question. Are the unyielding laws of the physical world, whether that is the economic gravity of supply chain margins, the rusted dependencies of legacy corporate code, or the strict orbital mechanics of our solar system, are those the only true speed limits left on human progress?
Man, it makes you wonder how much faster we'd go if we weren't constantly dragging the weight of the physical world behind us. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you, and we'll catch you on the next one.